Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Don and Dude.
What you talking about, Don? It's the Album Nerds Podcast. I'm Dude. I got Don with me.
Sorry. Nanu. That was still going in 81, wasn't it?
I think so. You're ready then for 1981 and for Mork and Mindy?
Oh, yeah.
God. So this is, of course, the Album Nerds Podcast. We love albums and the album format. Talking about them. All those songs lovingly put together by the featured artists. We've got a great show for you today. Our I Love the 80s tour continues, and we're headed to 1981. Don and I will each be presenting an album from 1981, but we had a limitation. They had to be either country or pop.
Mm-hmm.
Try and challenge ourselves a little bit. Then, of course, Don will be asking us a deep question. Then we'll have some shout-outs to some other albums and album-related items we're digging. And then we'll spin the wheel of musical discovery to learn what type of albums we'll be talking about from 1982. But today, it's all about 1981.
That's what I'm talking about!
Yes, our I Love the 80s tour continues to 1981. Headlines are full of economic uncertainty and political tension, even as malls, arcades, and cable TV promise endless distraction. Screens glow with blockbuster fantasies and reruns, shaping how people dress, talk, and daydream. Within this atmosphere came interesting music. Today, one of us will present a country album from 1981, and the other will bring us a selection from the world of pop music. So grab your joystick and a Jell-O pudding nice. Pop. This is 1981.
All right, so there were a lot of things to consider in the country realm and in the, especially in the pop realm, at least for me. You, Don?
Oh, yeah.
I was considering if I had ended up on the country route, George Strait, Strait Country, I believe that was his debut album, and he brought more of a traditional sound back to country music, and I think that we'll see that bear out throughout the 80s. Mm-hmm. We're still feeling some late 70s vibes, I think, in the country of 1981. The Oak Ridge Boys, Fancy Free, only because of Elvira. I loved that song as a kid. I mean, I was a little kid, and they had a guy going, oom-bop, oom-bop, mow-mow. That was enough for me at the time.
Did you check out that Roseanne Cash album at all, 7 Year Ache? It's interesting. You know, it was hard to classify. I think they ended up marketing it as a country album, but it was kind of a pop record. It's pretty interesting. And of course, 1981, I mean, that's really where synth pop explodes. So mm-hmm. you have great albums from OMD, The Human League, Soft Cell, Duran Duran's debut. I wanted to do, but we do that a lot.
and I got the pop side. I mean, some of the pop albums I thought about were Olivia Newton-John, Physical, the album, you know, it's more about the song, and that was kind of the issue there. REO Speedwagon, High Infidelity would have been an interesting choice. I really did consider that. Journey, Escape, we did talk about Journey not too long ago.
Right.
The Go-Go's, Beauty and the Beat, Hall & Oates, Private Eyes. I mean, a lot was happening here. Rick Springfield, Working Class Hero. So there was a lot to choose from. But we went in different directions. So the picks are in. 1981 is calling, and we're about to answer. Let's get to our cha-cha-cha choices.
You choo-choo choose me?
I picked a country album from 1981, and I went with the band Alabama and their album Feels So Right. this was released in February of that year. It's their fifth album. They were formed in, guess what state?
Alabama!
Actually, Fort Payne, Alabama.
I would hope so.
Alabama. It was Randy Owen, lead vocals and rhythm guitar, Ted Gentry on bass and vocals, Jeff Cook on guitar, fiddle, keyboards, everything else, and Mark Herndon on drums. Kind of, blended traditional country with elements of, you know, southern rock and pop. Lots mm-hmm. of tight vocal harmonies. Let's get right to it. Here's the opening cut and title track, Feels So Right.
Feels so right. Okay. There's something so like satin sheetsy about yes. A lot of these songs somehow, even though they are country music with finger quotes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, people have satin sheets in Alabama. So Feel So Right was written by Randy Owen. Again, as you alluded to, kind of a straightforward romantic sentiment, mid-tempo kind of ballad. I'll just start out saying it reminds me of some Eagles songs, maybe Tequila Sunrise or something. And it definitely has that vibe, and the harmonies, yeah, are a big part of that, I think.
Yeah, there's a FM adult contemporary rock thing going on here, for sure. I would say it's informed by the music of bands like the Eagles.
Yes.
I like it as an opener. I think it's kind of a confident choice. It's prioritizing the romance part instead of being like fiddle forward or something, But if you look at the album cover, it's like a saddlebag or something. So you still know that these are real country boys. Yes,
absolutely. Yeah, interesting choice to start with a quieter one. A lot of times you start the album off with, kind of a rocker.
Maybe it's just like, hey, this whole record feels so right.
It does. And this album was their first number one album. And, for those who, aren't aware, I mean, Alabama really dominated the country charts in this era.
I think kind of filled that space that went vacant from the late 70s, like Eagles-type country-tinged rock. This was rock-tinged country.
Good point. All right, well, here's another big cut from the album, Love in the First Degree. Lock me away, inside of your love, throw away
the key, I'm guilty. This is great. It seems kind of silly now, but that's pretty solid.
Yeah.
It's a solid way to frame love and relationships as a sentence, yeah. Whether that's good or bad, like in this case, it's good. Mm-hmm. It's not death row. It's love in the first degree.
Yeah. I mean, that's true. That's country storytelling there, often using a fun metaphor like that. Love in the First Degree was actually written by Tim Dubois and Jim Hurt, who are...
That's too fancy.
Yeah. But they are, seasoned Nashville songwriters. So again, lead vocals from Randy Owen. I mean, it's a nice, country delivery. Not over the top with the twang, but he's a Southern gentleman when he sings.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, there's definitely, there's a lot of compression on this record, and I think even more so on their albums after this. But that's what I think kind of gives it that radio-friendly vibe, where the vocals, the music, like all of it is like dialed in together. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of dynamic shifts where the vocals are louder, the music is louder. It's all kind of pressed together.
Yeah. Although somehow you still can make out all the separate parts, which is nice. Yeah. So I guess that's the genius of it. Yeah, the song just has a more fun vibe. But I think a lot of the rest of the album is more serious romance.
Right.
And this one is, maybe a little comic relief.
Well, these guys have beautiful beards and feathered hair. I'm sure romance was not a problem.
I'm sure. Yeah. Well, was there a track you wanted to highlight?
Yeah, there's one that goes quite dark.
Yeah.
Doesn't sound it on the surface, but when you read the lyrics, it's like, damn, this is nasty. So why don't we listen to a little bit of Hollywood? And what it's all about. From too many nights upon the casting couch. You can start to get the picture here. Yeah. So this one tells the story of a young Georgia woman who moves to Los Angeles. Why wasn't she an Alabama woman? What are they? They got a problem with Georgia? And she goes to Los Angeles to chase her dreams of being a movie star, but things don't go so well. There's the whole kind of Me Too-ishness of the casting couch thing where you get the feeling what's going on. There's a point where she's on a stage on a hardwood barroom floor. So you kind of get the feeling she's become a dancing entertainer of some kind, and mm-hmm. there's some hints of her standing on a corner. So, and then it seems to end with her taking her own life. So, like, the Hollywood dream is just this ugly, nasty thing, especially from a Southern perspective. You know, don't leave the small town and go to this debauchery-ridden place. Yeah. It's going to end badly. But the music just doesn't sound like that. But then it's more traditional country sounding, right. I think, this one.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me a lot of Lion Eyes.
Uh-huh. Sonically, yeah, for sure.
And you have, I mean, the Lion Eyes isn't as extreme, but you have a woman sort of, you know, doing things she otherwise wouldn't have done, or, you know,
right.
going through some changes to get by or whatever. From 2026 ears and perspective, like, I'm a little uncomfortable with it. Like, I you know, there's some inherent judgment in it, and like men singing about a woman's plight or something. It feels,
well. Yeah, I guess if I were to try and put my finger on that, it feels more like she didn't stand a chance because she's just a woman, you know? And, you know, times were different, and, you know, so I can't really look at it from 2026 eyes, but you don't have to look at it like it's misogynistic, because right. I don't think that was the intent.
No. Absolutely. But it is, you know, again, it's storytelling, and, you know, songs like that usually draw me in, and, you know, this certainly does.
But this was written by Gary Stewart and Wayne Carson. So they were not part of the band, but they were a well-known songwriting duo in Nashville at the time.
Okay, so we arrive at the final cut, I'm Stoned. That's the title of the song. I'm not making a...
It's okay, Don. It is 2026 after all.
If she ever comes home, I've had no sleep.
It's funny, with all these songs, the title of the song always comes at the end of the hook. You notice that?
Yeah.
So, I'm Stone was written by Owen and Gentry, about someone dealing with heartbreak and numbness through drinking. So it's not stoned in the marijuana sense, I don't think.
Right.
I think, was there a time where people would refer to being drunk as being stoned?
Not in my experience, but you never know. Yeah.
Wasn't that a Scott Baio, like, after school special called Stoned?
Yes, but he was smoking a lot of dope.
Oh, that's right.
I watched that not too long ago. Made him mean. Yeah. Made him stop doing his homework, which, that, let's be fair, that probably is accurate.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, so an interesting, you know, kind of, you know, quiet end to the album. I think, you know, Owen's vocal delivery, it's kind of subdued and, you know, gives kind of an introspective vibe. I think it's effectively done.
Yeah, I think as a closer it works. It sort of winds things down for the album, maybe for the relationship that was started in the opening track. I'm not sure, you know, if it's referring to the same thing, probably not, but that one, the openers certainly got more of a
let's get it on.
Yes, that kind of vibe. And this, I feel, is more of a breakup depression song, you know. I think you're right. I don't think it's about weed. I think it's just about being numb and lost and trying to cope, you know, with heartbreak and loneliness and listening to sad music and drinking and just wallowing in it. Struggling to find the narrator's bearings again, you know. Lyrics like, my eyes are getting heavy and my head spinning round, still wondering if she'll ever come home. I've had no sleep. Sad songs. I'm stoned. So, you know, it brings things down, but I think it's one of the more relatable tracks on the album. So I think it's a good way to close, a good human way to close, and feel like this is a journey we've all experienced to some degree. So I'm happy with how they turned down the lights on this one.
Yeah. Yeah. It kind of reminds me of like an old Hank Williams tune or something, where he's kind of left in despair. Although, you know, it's not quite as dark as where Hank would go.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and again, I think that's somewhat reflective of Alabama. You know, they're tugging at your heartstrings, but they don't go too, you know, too
deep. They don't go too deep. Yeah. I mean, this is supposed to be pop adjacent pop rock, you know?
Yep. Yeah. Well, let's rewind and reflect on Alabama's Feel So Right. I'll begin with my clickbait headline. Eagles minus California equals Alabama. I don't know why okay. why I made it a math equation, but yeah, you know, I just immediately from listening to it, it just reminded me so much of the Eagles, which I found interesting. And I like the idea, you know, because obviously the Eagles were influenced by country. And now you have, I feel like you have the Eagles kind of giving back to country, you know?
Yeah.
So that's always cool when that kind of thing happens.
Yeah.
But the, you know, the vocal, the, you know, particularly the harmonies, you know, really, you know, remind me of the Eagles. And it really works, I think, in this context.
Mm-hmm. My clickbait headline to describe Feels So Right. Polish country hits sung by a band that looks like they could give a TED talk on beard maintenance. Hmm. Yeah. So their look is just so like not cowboyish.
Yeah.
It's kind of rocker, but also kind of gentleman because they got these nice trimmed beards and
right. Cleaner than like 38 Special.
Yeah. Yeah. They don't look, yeah, they don't look like Lynyrd Skynyrd or anything, right. You know, but their album intentionally smooths out country for mass appeal. It results in this kind of warm, melodic, polished sound that is, like we say, kind of closer to adult contemporary and soft rock than traditional country. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it does feel designed, but it was well designed. And like you said, it's the Eagles with Southern cred.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, I mean, I feel like so much country, you know, of the 70s, like a George Jones, came from like a character who was self-destructive and,
right.
and kind of ugly, even though the songs were, you know, very polished and you know, palatable. But, you know, this sort of changes the presentation here. So Killer to Filler, I like Ride the Train. That's one that feels more, that's maybe the one where you start to get sort of old fashioned country instrumentation and bluegrass. Yeah, I think it's kind of a tribute to, you know, other songs that have been about trains, you know, like Orange Blossom yeah. Special.
Yeah, you know, the endless number of train songs by Johnny Cash.
Yes, exactly. Is there a box set that has one CD that's all trains?
So. I think so.
That song, Fantasy, it just stayed in my head all the way. Fantasy, you and me. Just, I couldn't get it out of my head. So I guess that's probably a good one.
Oh, there was a couple of Flame tunes. You know, we had Old Flame. It was sort of more of an emotional, slow burn Alabama doing feeling.
Yeah.
You know, very, very emotional.
I think that was actually the first single.
Oh, yeah. Okay. And then there was also See the Embers, Feel the Flame.
Oh, yeah.
What'd you think of that one?
I like that one. I think that one is actually sung by Jeff Cook. You know, so there's a okay. couple of tracks that are sung by other members. So, yeah, that's a pretty good one as well.
I mean, you know, like We've Got Tonight was – it's not filler. I mean, none of this is really filler because it is what it is in yeah. this case, you know. But that one – it's like, okay, enough yeah. of this stuff.
Right.
You know? Yeah, I was kind of – we get a couple darker ones again?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, and then what's the storytelling one early? Burn, Georgia, Burn, which I
like that one.
I think that one – is that set in Civil War time?
Yeah, I had read that it had something to do with the burning of Atlanta in 1864.
Oh, right.
So, yeah, I think it could have been also referencing other things, like, but I think that's maybe the core of it at least. Southern tradition,
yep.
history, all that stuff.
Okay. Production, you know, as you said, you know, very shiny, you know, pop mm-hmm. production. I mean, I think Nashville, you know, since the 60s was, they had a formula, you know, with the orchestration and, you know, making a sort of a you know, pop sounding or palatable pieces. But, you know, this takes it a step further, kind of compressed.
Yeah, I mean, the sound was perfectly aligned with early 80s radio standards, and I think it positioned Alabama as crossover ready. You know, it's country music polished to survive pop radio and later MTV, and it did. And so, yeah, that is very tight compression, but that's okay.
I should mention it was co-produced by Harold Shedd and Larry McBride.
Okay.
All right, replay value?
Yeah, I mean, there's some good tracks on here. I have it on vinyl, so I will spin it occasionally. Picked it up, you know, fairly inexpensively.
Yeah.
I like some songs from other albums as well. So more likely, I would hit a greatest hits if I really mm-hmm. wanted to get the full Alabama experience. But I thought they were cool for a country band when I was a little kid. Like, it was okay to listen to. It wasn't embarrassing to listen to, but that's about it.
Yeah, I will probably listen to it again. I'm not in love with the record. I went into it with pretty modest expectations, and I would say they were, you know, exceeded a little bit. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some good pop songwriting here, and you know, some good vocals. So it's definitely worth listening to. You know, I don't feel very passionately about this album.
Yeah. It was fun digging in, not just, I'd listened to it in the past, but it was nice to have a reason to pay attention.
Yeah. And as far as legacy goes, I think this did kind of set the tone for country music and the sound of country music in the 1980s. And I think people who came later, like a Garth Brooks, were, you know, probably influenced by, by this kind of treatment.
Yeah. It's really a blueprint record for crossover country success that weren't like, or before this era, you know, with your Eddie Rabbits and your Alabamas and Crystal Gales and stuff, crossover country songs were novelty type things.
Yeah.
Like Elvira, that they had the Mbappa Mau Mau stuff. And this is where it really started to become legitimate crossover pop country. And I think that's where it really gets established.
Yeah. So Feel So Right became the sound of early 1980s country radio, accessible, polished, and unapologetically focused on what fans wanted to hear. Is it what you want to hear? Give it a spin and let us know.
Excuse me, I'd like to ask you a few questions.
It's time again for Deep Questions by Don. So we're deep in 1981, so let's talk about some other significant music-related moments of this year. What do you think was the most significant musical moment or development of 1981?
Well, you know, there's probably one enormous, impactful thing that happened to music, really, in 1981.
I love my MTV.
MTV was launched August 1st, 1981, a 24-hour cable channel devoted entirely to music videos hosted by VJs instead of DJs, disc jockeys and video jockeys, I suppose.
Martha Quinn, Alan Hunter, J.J. Jackson, Mark Goodman.
Well, yeah, you watched it more than I did. I only got to see it at my grandma's house once in a while. MTV famously launched with Video Killed the Radio Star by the Buggles. So that's like so symbolic because it not only the lyrics, you know, are about video and radio and whatever, but I don't feel like that song probably would have been a hit if it weren't for MTV. Yeah. So,
and that was typical of the early MTV playlist because anything they could find. And it happened to be a lot of like British new wave and stuff. And so that really, you know, pushed, you know, that genre.
Yeah. The source material for videos was small. The budgets were small, but it changed how music was marketed. Image became as important as sound. Duran Duran, Madonna, Michael Jackson, Prince, I think of those as some of the biggest behemoths of the early, early MTV years that just dominated the channel. And then, of course, it expanded into metal and hip-hop and other genres as time went on. And it played a huge role in shaping 80s pop, rock, fashion, youth culture, and 90s as well. But today, MTV is pretty much reality shows, infomercials. No music only for, they had some offshoot channels that were music only, but those are all gone. Those dedicated music channels are gone. They don't really do anything with music except for the MTV Video Music Awards. It's a shame.
I think young people think I'm being hyperbolic when I talk about how influential MTV was on me. I mean, it really was like...
It was like TikTok.
Yeah. It's my understanding of pop culture and stuff was all from, you know, framed by MTV.
You didn't know what was going on in the world if it wasn't on MTV News.
Exactly. Yeah.
It was the tastemaker for anything you liked was probably because you saw it on MTV. TV.
All right. Well, another moment from 1981 that probably wasn't quite as significant.
Not to kids.
Yeah. So Simon and Garfunkel reunited and, you know, performed a concert at Central Park in New York City. It was a free concert, you know, which had them, you know, on stage together for like the first time in 10 years. So it's a big moment in, you know, the world, in that world. But it was also, you know, big because it was, I mean, there was like 500,000 people there. It's one of the largest concerts in history. It was also a benefit. So it was, I think the goal was to raise money for the park, which, you know, I guess was, you know, falling, you know, into
disrepair or something.
Yeah. And I feel like the 80s had a lot of benefit shows. I mean, of course, you had Live Aid, but then you had the Farm Aid thing and Freedom Fest. And
but yeah, I didn't give a crap about this. I was a very little kid, but it was just some old people stuff.
Right. And I wouldn't have given a crap at the time either. But of course, 10 years later, Paul Simon did this by himself, you know, which seemed like kind of a nephew to Mr. Garfunkel.
Poor Mr. Garfunkel. The name alone makes it tough to not feel sorry for the man.
All right. Well, what are some other significant events of 1981? Let us know on our social media, like Instagram and Facebook at Album Nerds.
I got the pop side of the coin for 1981. So I went with Men at Work. Men at Work were a Melbourne pub band. Melbourne, Australia, formed in 1978, blending rock, reggae, grooves, and R&B influences into long, crowd-tested jam-type stuff. And they found their way into a tighter mix of those songs, a more poppy mix, led by Colin Hay, a Scottish-born songwriter raised in Australia. He moved there when he was 14, I believe. And the band really started focusing on strong melodies and in that sharp observational lyrics, rather than going synth heavy. But Greg Hamm, who is the multi-instrumentalist for the band, his saxophone and flute added these quirky melodic bits that gave this band a new wave sheen, I guess you would call it. But the lineup here was Colin Hay, Greg Hamm, Ron Streichert on guitar, John Reese on bass, Jerry Spicer on drums. The album is Business as Usual, released November 1981 in Australia. I believe it was 1982 when it came out in America.
Yeah, but we'll let that go.
It was their debut, and it spent an unprecedented 15 weeks at number one on the US Billboard 200 at a time where Michael Jackson and stuff were ruling the airwaves. They brought a unique pop sound and blended humor and anxiety with some really interesting, almost world music touches. So why don't we listen to a little bit of the opener, Who Can It Be Now? So I believe this is the lead single, released in July of 81. It's about anxiety, social paranoia, self-isolation. This would have fit in real nice during the COVID era. Yeah. Essentially, the narrator is hiding from the world. People are knocking at his door. Dun, dun, dun. They do a drum thing that sounds like the door knock. I love that. And he just wants to be left alone. I guess Colin Hay wrote this after moving into a new apartment, feeling intruded upon by door-to-door salesmen and noisy neighbors. But that sax riff really kind of defines the track, because it's like a call and response thing. You know, the sax plays and then Colin responds.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah. It actually reminds me of some of that Huey Lewis stuff from the early 80s.
Fun, cool, but sort of from a more mature mind.
Yeah. Yeah. And even, you know, even the video treatments were similar. You know, I think both vocalists did a good job of using their face or something to, you know,
close ups with funny eye movements and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But the crisp staccato guitar lines and the bass kind of they're all sort of like mimicking each other and that narrator's anxiety. But yeah, I mean, there's some psychological angles to it. It's more than meets the eye.
Mm-hmm.
It's a robot in disguise. But it does set the tone for the album, this kind of slightly off-kilter new wave sensibility, maybe, you know, the Australian attitude. Mm-hmm. I mean, perhaps that's coming through as well. And there wasn't a lot of Australian music making its way into the American pop charts at the time. So I think maybe we were catching a flavor of humor that we hadn't before in music. But that sax is an iconic sax hook. I mean, so love it.
I really enjoy Colin Hay's vocal delivery. You know, mm-hmm. it's very It's very smooth. Somehow it almost feels like another instrument, or like a brass or woodwind instrument or something. You know, I mean, it doesn't have a beautiful voice or anything, but it's just so perfect for these songs.
All right. So the next track I want to talk about goes kind of a different direction sonically. And this one's a little more like outsider storytelling. Why don't we check out a little bit of Be Good Johnny?
Play football with you, John? No? Oh. You must be going to play cricket this year, then, are you, John?
So it's like a narrative-driven song exploring youthful boredom and rebellion. I think I read it was about a nine-year-old character that he came up with named Johnny. But like all these expectations and the parents constantly yelling at him, be good. And the adults asking, what are you doing this summer? What are your interests? And he uses a different voice when Johnny's being asked all these questions. Like, nah. And I feel like there's a Johnny Be Good. It's not a direct Johnny Be Good reference to the Chuck Berry song, but the themes of youth and rebellion carry over from it. Sure. So I think using that to bring out like a nostalgia vibe works.
Yeah, I think some people kind of dismiss this as like a silly song, you know, but I think if it was part of a rock opera or something,
right,
you know, it would be more appreciated, you know, like a Happy Jack or something, you know, from The Who, or, you know, it just.
Yes.
I like this song a lot. I always have. It kind of reminds me of like Devo, in that you're never quite sure whether to take it seriously or not. Yeah, you know, I mean, these are obviously like serious musicians, but are they being ironic, or, you know, are they really, you know, saying something directly? And I like that. You know, I like when you're just sort of wondering if it's, you know, silliness or not, you know.
Or you take, you know, like I took it seriously, but you have the option. I like that there's the option. Other people could just think it's funny. Right. I thought of it as a serious, with you know, a humorous takes within it, but ultimately just being barked at about be good, behave, do what you're told. That's youthful rebellion in a nutshell. And that's part of, you know, the rock and roll vibe, right? Or was. What about you, Don? You got something special you want to talk about?
Yeah.
The obvious song?
Yeah.
We do have to
talk about it, and for good reason, because it's a great song. Down Under.
Manchunder. I love the different, they change it up where what the women do and what the men do. And but the men chunder, I think that's throwing up, right?
That makes sense. So Down Under was written by Hay and Streichert, supposedly based on Hay's observations and feelings about Australian culture and identity. This is one of the more reggae-sounding tracks. You know, reggae just had such a huge influence on a lot of British music, you know, like the Police, and then that like whole ska movement. But this, for some reason, the reggae on this album, it doesn't sound like the other ska groups, you know, like the English Beat or the Specials. I'm not sure what it is that makes it different. Maybe it just doesn't have as much of the chicka chicka, whatever sound in it.
The M'Chaka, as I call it.
I was waiting for you to pop that in.
Yeah. M'Chaka.
Yeah, it doesn't really do that much, but it definitely has a reggae vibe to it.
What do you think about this? So, obviously, there's the flute, the Greg Ham flute, but the little percussive thing there at the beginning, it was bottles filled with water at different levels. Nice. I love that shit.
That's cool. Speaking of that flute, there was a lawsuit. So apparently there was a song from like the 1930s called Kookaburra Sits in the Old Gum Tree, which is basically almost exactly that line. So they did have to give some royalties to whoever owned the copyright on that song.
Evidently, it was completely unintentional. Sure. And
I think it often is.
He just played a flute part. And then later regretted doing it because they ended up having to give up so much dough. Even though it was only 5%, it was still
a
significant amount of money.
It's a huge song.
Yeah, I mean, all of these songs, we talked about this a little bit in the 1980 episode, the saxophone being so prevalent in all types of pop music, and we have it here. It's all over the place. Most of the time you don't notice it, which is exactly where it should be.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point.
It's in almost every song, but it's not like a big sax solos. It's just like one of the part of the canvas, you know, of the album.
Particularly on this song, but throughout the album, they do a good job with Hayes. I think he does all the backing vocals too. And, you know, he harmonizes with himself. And I like the second time you get to the chorus of the song, you've got like the high part on it. It sounds so good.
Let's close out the album. This one's called Down by the Sea. Just song's over 6 minutes long, which is quite unusual for certainly my expectations. And it wasn't too long. Like, it could have gone longer.
Sure.
Yeah. The flow of it, the way it does sound like by the sea, it does sound, you know, kind of what I would imagine an Australian Jimmy Buffett might do.
Interesting.
But it's contemplative. Yeah, that's right. That's how you say it. Not contemplative. I've heard it both ways. Yes. But it's atmospheric, and it really, it's a richly textured song that closes out the album beautifully. It's meditative. It's got a sonic landscape. It really shows this group of guys. It's not just kooky, you know, it's not funny new wave stuff. It's strategically placed and a powerful capstone, moving the album's focus from political and cultural satire to more personal introspection, and it works really well.
Yeah, and this one supposedly just came out of a jam session, and you can really hear it, you know?
Love that.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, again, you know, in the new wave era, you don't get a lot of that sort of thing.
Well, that's not where these guys came from. They kind of found themselves there because they were kind of quirky and a little weird. So where else, you got to put him in new wave.
Yeah.
Again, you got Ham throwing in all these really sophisticated little bits of sound, saxophone, flute that fill out these songs, all of them. So much of the character comes from Ham's multi-instrumental approach and Hayes' captivating, interesting vocal deliveries.
Absolutely.
All right. So why don't we take a little time to rewind and reflect on business as usual. Okay, so I'll kick it off with my clickbait headline to describe the album. This album's a bonza, blend of ska, reggae, new wave, and pop hooks that'll have you grinning like a gala.
Jeez.
A gala is, I guess, some kind of bird, but also people use it, I guess, in Australia to refer to fools.
Okay.
But it's pop and new wave with quirky, clever, slightly anxious energy, which I feel it and I like it. It's personality driven, and, you know, where Alabama was out there smoothing everything out, Men at Work were kind of embracing personality, nervous energy, and observational storytelling in a completely different way. And these two things existed at the same time. I think that's so awesome.
Yes.
And they were, you know, could have potentially been played on the same radio station.
Yep.
You know, I love that. It's energetic, ironic, and clever, and it's a perfect early 80s snapshot of music and where things were going.
Yeah. Well, my clickbait headline is, business as usual tastes good on first bite, unlike Vegemite. Have you ever tried Vegemite?
I haven't. It's like fermented yeast, right?
Yeah.
It's like a paste.
It's just so salty, and it has like this, just this weird taste to it that's not really pleasant. But I could see acquiring a taste for it.
Right. Well, I mean, you're a vegetarian, so you have to go try things
that
have veg in the name because you know it's safe.
That's true. But yeah, I mean, this is, I guess it's the best of both worlds, because I think it is appealing immediately, but there is more to it, you know, below the surface. There's a lot of little just flourishes and just clever things on this album that, you know, that make it pretty special.
So killer to filler, as we reviewed the songs here, some of the others we liked. I'm just going to say up front, filler, no. I didn't detect any. But killer-wise, like the second track, I can see it in your eyes. Such a nice change of pace from Who Can It Be Now. It's so glad that is between that and Down Under.
Mm-hmm.
It's a reflective look at relationship in decline and emotional distance, but it feels personal. But it's also, like, again, musically very interesting. They keep your attention even if you're not listening to the words.
Yeah, I think that does start with sort of a synth line, you know, that makes it, you know, kind of sound like that stuff. There's a cut, Helpless Automaton.
Oh, I love that one.
What I think, Haim sings. I think he does the vocals on that, and it reminds me of the Cars. Like, his delivery kind of reminds me of, like, Benjamin Orr, just the phrasing or something.
I guess it feels more Devo-y to me, but
yeah. Well, they're all kind of related, I think, in some ways.
Catch a Star. What do you think about that one?
You know, it's because it comes later in the album. I think it didn't stand out to me initially, but it's one I kind of made sure that I paid some attention to later. And it actually is a pretty good song.
Underground was great, too.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, no duds.
Yeah. And that one was a little more urgent. But that also had a more modern new wave vibe to it. Nice energy. Yeah. Even though the big hits are up front, they continue to engage you with these energetic tunes throughout, and I love that. Okay. Production-wise, it's open, airy. The mix is dynamic. They use space well with those quirky arrangements, the flute and percussion, and all these interesting sounds they bring in. And it's all clearly defined, and every sound they're making serves the songs.
Yeah. So the album was produced by Peter McKeon, who's also known for producing Mr. Mister, but kind of a, you know, your pop producer. I gotta say, the vocals, I mean, they did such a good job with layering Hayes, you know, harmonies. I mean, I don't think anybody would say their favorite, you know, vocalist is Colin Hay, but something special about, you know, the way he sings. You know?
Yeah, that personality, that daydreamy vibe. I mean, it even comes through for fans of the show Scrubs.
Yeah.
He appeared in several episodes, part of the main character JD's constant fantasies and daydreaming. And I feel like Colin Hay was doing that. He was a daydreamer, and it came out in his songs.
Yes, absolutely.
Replay value, very high. My wife bought this for me on vinyl not too long ago, and I've been listening to it a lot, even before prepping for this show. The deep tracks reveal subtle hooks and lyrical cleverness on repeat listens, and the album just keeps growing the more I listen to it, and it stays fresh. I was familiar with the hits when I was a youngster, but digging into the rest of it has been awesome.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to listen to it a lot as well. It's not one I've spent a lot of time with. So, you know, I keep uncovering new things with each listen. So, yeah.
I feel like it's underrated.
It definitely is.
Yeah. Legacy-wise, I feel like this helped to redefine what early 80s pop was supposed to sound like. And then this kind of international reach and the personality-driven songwriting. It's clever and ironic. And when I think of early MTV, being a little kid at grandma's house, always was happy when I'd see Colin Hay and his antics in the videos. So
yeah, I wonder if the MTV videos maybe hurt their long term potential because their videos were so goofy and quirky. I think people sort of, you know, didn't take them seriously, you know, like they did a U2,
right?
Or, you know, yeah, I think sometimes that can, you know, that can backfire. I mean, you know, they had plenty of success. So, I mean, it's not, you know, but, you know, maybe if they were presented in a more serious manner, maybe they would have had a longer career.
Yeah. A tightly crafted blend of catchy hooks, clever lyrics, quirky instrumentation, business as usual, established men at work is a defining voice of early 80s pop and new wave. Please check it out.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
All right. So we've been playing Space Invaders and Pac-Man on our little Ataris.
Don't play Pac-Man on the Atari. You got the arcade. The one on Atari was unplayable.
Yeah. They did redeem themselves because they did miss Pac-Man, and that was much better.
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, while you were playing Atari, did you get a chance to listen and dig anything else?
It's tough because there's not a lot of new releases are not hitting yet here in 2026 for the most part. So I dug around a little bit to try and see if I missed something in 2025. And I did. From January of 2025, an old favorite of both of ours, you and me. The band is called Ours. The album was Rockets Red Glare. Ours are an American alternative rock band led by singer-songwriter Jimmy Necco, really the driving force, I think the only constant member. But they're known for the dramatic, emotive vocals, kind of cinematic songwriting, and they've been active since the late 90s. This album, Rockets Red Glare, is their seventh studio LP, released January 6, 2025. So why don't we dive into a little bit of Bells?
There he is.
Dude can still sing. Yeah. You know, driving guitars, lush arrangements, but really Necco's signature vocal style is the star of the show here. I listened to it when it came out, and it kind of got shuffled to the back of the shelf, and I'm going to give it another college try here. But I really, their first couple of albums tend to be where I stick. But I'm just happy that Ours is still out there doing their thing.
Me too.
We saw them a lot of times. Back in the early 2000s. All right, next up for me, I always try and pick something from my vinyl collection. And as we're doing these, our tour of loving the 80s, I'm trying to stick to the years. So this album from 1981 by a band called Red Rider, it's called As Far As Siam. As Far As Siam. Heyo. Canadian rock band formed in Toronto in the mid-1970s, led by singer-songwriter Tom Cochran, also, you know, later known for Life is a Highway.
Yeah. I wondered where he came from.
Well, Red Rider, my friend. They're known for their melodic heartland rock or album-oriented radio sound. Eventually, I guess they recorded as Tom Cochran and Red Rider. Doesn't ring as well.
No.
Why don't we listen to the opening track from As Far As Siam called Lunatic Fringe. Yeah, so, you know, kind of a Bryan Adams meets Pink Floyd vibe on this one anyway. But yeah, Lunatic Fringe was a minor hit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I picked up this album a long time ago specifically because I liked that song and I didn't know much about the band beyond that. It's an enjoyable listen.
Yeah, I'm going to have to spend some time with it.
Yeah, you should check it out. All right, Donnie, what are you digging?
Well, I'm going to thank the New Wave Music Podcast again for introducing me to two albums from this past year. The first is from a younger band called Nite, N-I-T-E. Their self-titled debut album. Yeah, their self-titled debut album, you know, came out last year. It's twin brothers, Kyle and Miles Mendez. Kind of I guess they call it dark wave and synth pop. Here's a track called All Your Pain.
There it is. I'll try it for you, but I think a lot of pain's going to be involved on my side.
Just the drums on like industrial and like dark wave records. They're never like normal. It's never like a normal drum sound. It's always like, you know, just some weird compressed sort of bucket being hit or something. I don't know. anyway, and another one, more of a legacy thing, Ashes and Diamonds. Cleverly, the album is called Are Forever. It's a super group. Daniel Ash, who was a founder of Bauhaus, you know, which also had Peter Murphy and Love and Rockets. Remember Love and Rockets? I'm alive. Uh-huh, so alive.
No, I remember the name, but I don't remember that song.
Don't know what color your eyes are, baby, but your hair is long and brown.
Yes, you should have started there.
Sorry.
You just wanted more, time to sing.
Yes, I did. Also, Bruce Smith from Public Image Limited and Paul Spencer Denman from Sadie and Sweetback. I don't know them. But anyway, they've been working together for a while, but they finally came out with an album. Here's a song called Boy or Girl.
I actually did listen to this earlier in the year, kind of unaware of who was on it. I liked it.
Yeah. I'll have to go back and do a Bauhaus record one of these days.
Yeah.
So what are you digging? Let us know. Join us on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky @Album Nerds.
it will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
Well, here it is. It's about time on the show when I'm reminded of the words of filmmaker and journalist Cameron Crowe. He said, "The 80s were really about having fun, even when everything else felt like it was falling apart." When isn't that every era that could be said, Mr. Crowe?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
But with that in mind, let's bring out the Wheel of Musical Discovery to find out what genres we'll be covering as we explore 1982.
Next time, we continue our I Love the 80s series with 1982. Big guitars meet bold left turns as we dive into rock and the rest, spotlighting two albums that show how the early 80s balanced mainstream power with adventurous, off-the-beaten-path sounds.
Rock, nice. The rest, uh-oh. So,
yes.
I think we're looking at things that do not fit into the standard genres, right? Like maybe some jazz or blues or...
Yeah. Maybe some gospel, maybe some avant-garde, postmodern stuff.
Good Lord. I call rock.
How about the guy that just has the song that's like 3 minutes and 33 seconds of silence?
That's not a song. Just,
well, maybe we'll talk about it next week.
I hope not.
Tune in next week. What's your favorite record from 1982? To what else are you listening? Email us at podcast@albumnerds.com or follow us on Instagram and other social media at Album Nerds. And you can visit albumnerds.com to listen to all 321 episodes. The best way to support the show is to share it. Please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app.
Thank you so much for joining us here on the Album Nerds podcast. Please join us next time as we continue loving the 80s in 1982.
All right, you ready to guess the 1981 television show?
Hit it.
Believe it or not,
greatest American hero. Oh, should I let you finish your wordplay?
I always think of Seinfeld now with George Costanza's.
Believe it or not, George is at home. Please leave a message at the beep.
That's so great. And the best part about it is like Jerry ends up humming it later.
Yeah. But Greatest American Hero. Yes. Love that show.
I never really watched it. I mean, I remember it being on, but I don't remember it.
Just a dorky teacher that became a superhero. All right. Enough about that. Thanks again for listening. We'll catch you next time.